Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Kevin Beckham.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gassilin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, we're back with another podcast of Not the Footy Show, and it's always good to be back. Thank you to everyone who downloaded the last edition, because we had a lot of interest in that one, and hopefully we'll have a lot of interest with this show, because we're catching up again with David Mitchell over in the United Kingdom, who is a personal brand and reputation consultant with a specialty in F1 and racing drivers. And what we're talking to him about is fandom.
David Mitchell.
Not David Mitchell, no. This is a different David Mitchell.
Okay.
But anyway, he's going to talk about fandom, John, and what makes fans so fanatical. Why is it some of them, you know, feel they continue their loyalty? Why some paint their faces? And just how, again, in the social media sphere now, how you have to treat your fans and how you've got to kind of calm them down when they get a little bit excited. And also he's going to tell us about burging and coughing.
Okay. Do you know what they are?
I do, but I will. You'll hear after the interview anyway. I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lay.
Good to be back. Now,
yes.
Am I starting or are you starting?
You can start. I'm croaky today.
You are croaky. Very French. The frog in the throat. Look, I was very fortunate, John, to attend the Hall of Champions dinner at the Pan Pacific. And, look, it is great that we have a place where we recognise the top Western Australian athletes. And it was a really good night. I must admit, I enjoyed it. Belinda Stowell, who was inducted from sailing, was fantastic. What a great speaker. What an inspirational woman. Bevan George, again, from the sport of hockey and from the town of Narrogin. They now have two inductees from the town of Narrogin.
Wow.
Barry Cable being the other. And again, he just spoke from the heart and he won the whole room over. Gary Bucanara from AFL was another one that was inducted. And then it was the netball team, the women's netball team from 1969 to 71, who won the national championships. Now, one thing I will say, that's not an era. It kept being billed as they dominated an era. 4 years is not really an era. If you look it up, it's a lengthy period of time is an era.
It's still a great,
it's still a great achievement. I'm not putting them down, but I think, you know, there's pumping it up and getting the wording right. But I think the thing that kind of concerns me, and I do think we need something like this, and as I say, it was a very good night. But again, I've attended these over the years. It's been running since 1985. It was established. And if you look at it, then now I think that's what my mass 33 years.
Yeah, long enough.
There's just so many players from the sport we don't mention on this show that they have more inductees than any other sport. And on the night, and this is not in any way trying to denigrate Gary Bucanara, but when you hear Bevan George and Belinda Stoll talking about Olympic Games, World Championships, you know, competing at that level, and he's talking about state of origin and playing in the VFL, there's a big, big gap.
Yes.
And so when you think, and I did the totting up this morning, 129 inductees, and there are 29, more than any other sport from the sport we don't mention. The next highest is hockey with 22 inductees. But again, if you look at the success that the Australian hockey team has had globally, in that period, in fact, since the 70s, and the players that we've produced, who, if you went overseas and you said the likes of Rochelle Hawkes' name, Rick Charlesworth's name, people know who they are, then you think, well, yeah, that these players do deserve to be there. But it just, I don't know, I just think there are some wonderful athletes in Western Australia who've achieved world recognition. And sometimes I know the criteria here. I will just read the criteria to be in. So you have to have an outstanding sporting achievement at the highest level. The athlete must be accepted as a product of the WA sporting system or have established their reputation while being a resident of Western Australia. And the athlete must have retired from the highest level of competition for 5 years. Now, if you just think, there's one guy, one of my favorite guests when we were on the radio, was Kieran Gorman, the aerobics, because
yeah,
he did it the hard way, yet he conquered the world and became the world champion. Now, to me, there's a guy again who was inspirational in his story, in that he had to fund himself, he managed to achieve it against all odds, there's a guy that again deserves to be in something like this.
Oh, I would agree with you. Is Steve Hooker a past winner of that?
I don't think he is. No, he won the Wace Athlete of the Year.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, he's not the in the. No, he's not in. He's not in this.
I mean, very often with these sort of state-based award systems, you find anomalies where someone like Steve Hooker wins it, but you wonder why he's a West Australian. You know, it's a bit like Adam Gilchrist winning it. His performances came from WA, most definitely.
Well, he is in the whole.
Yeah, but he's lauded not for his performances for WA. He's lauded for his performances for Australia, isn't he?
Correct. Yeah.
But he's from New South Wales.
Yeah.
And all of his junior development was in New South Wales. So does he also qualify to get the same award in New South Wales?
Well, I think you'll find there are a few athletes who are in more than one Hall of Fame. Or Hall of Champions, or whatever it's called, and they do get that recognition in two states. But yeah,
no, I mean nothing.
I think to be fair to Adam Gilchrist, as you say, yeah, he established himself as a player for Western Australia when he was making all those runs and doing so well for the Australian team, and he's chosen to stay and live here, having moved here. So I think he's very much an adopted Western Australian. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, look, nothing against any of those awards. People don't give themselves these awards. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely not. I think the thing I'm just saying is we need to have a bit more balance. I think there are a lot of sports other than just the one that dominates the media here. The one thing I did really love, though, John, was on the night the netballers stood up and actually had a pointed go at two former journalists from the West Australian newspaper, and said that when they were at their peak there for that four-year period, and I think they were unbeaten for 2 years, they said they could get nothing in our state newspaper. And I just thought, you know what? Nothing changes. It is still a garbage newspaper, and it always will be a garbage newspaper, in my opinion.
Well, when you get front-page stories like doctors fall off bikes, I mean...
And also when Nick Nat knew he broke a toenail, didn't he? And that was front page or something?
Oh, look, we're always going to fight against the football mafia in this state because they feel very threatened by the fact that they don't play internationally and that they can't draw on that. And so they have to impose themselves on the sporting landscape in some other way.
But I just think it's a pretty poor showing when you've got a newspaper that hasn't evolved with the population. And you have to look at that now, in that there are people, like cricket's numbers in participation have dropped away. Yet to me, cricket is actually the national sport in Australia, I think, because you take it far more seriously than anywhere else in the world, except possibly India now.
Well, it's national because it's played all over the country too, with equal verve. I mean, you can't say that New South Wales and Queensland follow AFL football.
Correct.
As equally as passionately as the rest of the country. But cricket is the one sport that we all follow passionately.
Yeah. And so, but I just think there are other sports again now, and if you look at netball is doing really well and it's getting, and it deserves the coverage, you know, that they've actually, especially in this state, I think a lot of credit needs to go to Netball WA in that they did a development program. If you look, it's now paying dividends and the players are coming through from the development program that was set up probably 5-6 years ago, when I think Stacey Rosman was then running that, and we were talking to her on the show, on the radio, about the development side of things.
Just as a sideline, because, you know, we never let our conversations trail off into other areas at all. Did you see Lisa Alexander's comments following the Tri Nation series about the state of the league? The national league here, and the number of international players that are coming to play in the league. And, you know, she made comment after Australia had lost the Commonwealth Games gold medal about, you know, the fact that all of these international players are now coming here, and that these other national teams are being strengthened because they're playing in our domestic competition. And so you're not only strengthening the opposition by allowing their players to come here and play, but you're keeping young Australian players out of positions in that league as well. It was interesting coming from the national coach.
Yeah, and I can hear that because her reputation and her job is based on results. Mm. So therefore, she doesn't want to be losing those international games against those nations because she could find herself out of a job. But I do think it's one of those very difficult ones because, I mean, you could look at the Hockey India League, and certainly Indian hockey benefited phenomenally from having the world's best players come and play alongside up-and-coming Indian players and having foreign coaches there. You can then look
That's because India aren't at the top.
Yeah, true, but they've come up a long way.
Yeah, but let's not forget we've had conversations about why they appear to have risen as high as they have in the world rankings.
Yeah, hosting tournaments and getting world rankings points, so, yeah. But let's be fair, John, they are a far more competitive side than they were 7 years ago.
Yeah, definitely, no doubt.
Okay, I mean, if you want to use another one, and we take the kabaddi. Now, I commentated the kabaddi at the Asian Games, and to be fair, the Kabaddi World Cup, India sent coaches overseas to try and raise the thing. Now, they lost for the first time ever the men's gold medal. And I have to say, commentating it, not because I didn't want India to win, but it was brilliant that somebody else beat India. And South Korea beat India first, and then Iran beat India as well, and Iran won the gold medal. And then the women went and beat the Indian women in the gold medal match in the women's event. Now, to me, that now gives the sport more credibility because it's not being dominated by the same faces, the same teams. Now you've actually taken it to the world. The world is catching up. And now there will be more interest because it's not purely India's going to win every time they take to the court.
But at what point, and this I think is the point that Lisa Alexander's bringing up, do you go, okay, they've caught up now. They don't need us to be selling ourselves short to make sure that they come up the ladder.
True, but then as you...
Well, at what point does that come? Does the coach say, okay, enough of that, get rid of all these international players, it's now working against us?
Yeah, but then you also have to look at, and as prime example of this, is can it survive without those international players? In that they pull people in, some of them, by having them there. Are you going to draw the crowds if you didn't have those in? And if you look at the A-League's a prime example, they think, bring in a big name, the crowds will come. Now, as we've seen with Del Piero, with Kuehl, with Fowler, the crowds dropped by 5,000 to 10,000 after fans had come and watched one game of that player playing. So it works for a bit, and it doesn't work for others. But then at the same time, you know, do you need the foreign influence to just make it that little bit more interesting?
I think what she was more getting at was cutting the number, not getting rid of them, so that the players that do come are the absolute A-grade top quality, and you're not training the lesser quality players up to a level for other nations. If you want to develop your players, you pay for the development coaches to come to your country and sort it all out. It's not our responsibility.
Yeah, look, I'm a big believer, as you know. I mean, I think the whole Usain Bolt thing is ridiculous, and I think it's disgraceful that he's prevented a young Australian with talent getting the opportunity.
You've got 2 or 3 minutes to jump on a soapbox. Why not hit Usain Bolt while you're here?
Look, I said a couple of podcasts ago that I thought it was a ridiculous situation. I think the thing that's really sad now is, again, and sadly, when you have a brand and you have a name as big as Usain Bolt here trialing, he took all the limelight away from the opening round of the A-League because his agent came out saying he'd been offered a contract. Everyone's going, wow, he's been... And suddenly the games became peripheral to whether Usain Bolt was finally going to be given this professional football contract that he's always dreamed of. Now, I don't think he is going to get it because the money, from what we hear... And hats off, because we said FFA, do not give them the money to fund his playing career here, and they haven't, because they said he falls outside the marquee status. So well done, FFA, credit where it's due. But yeah, I mean, to me, that was a circus.
Well, more on that, but let's get to the interview, shall we?
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. And it is with great pleasure we're going to welcome back now a guest who we had on the show earlier in 2018. And it was so interesting when we caught up with him then talking about player brands that I wanted to talk to him about the situation regarding fans. And so it's with great pleasure we welcome personal brand and reputation consultant David Mitchell back to Not the Footy Show. David Mitchell, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Well, thank you for having me back, Ashley.
Well, no, I really enjoyed our chat last time, and something came up, and I thought you may well be across this in your role. And it was really to do with how fans attach themselves to athletes and to teams. And I thought it was maybe something that you'd be across, and you might be able to help explain some of it to us.
Well, yeah, I certainly, you know, with through the work I do with, around brand and reputation management, work with racing teams on fan management and, you know, fan communication. So, yeah, something I get involved with on a regular basis.
Now, we've always been told, if you follow sport for years, that people get attached to teams or even players. And the reasons given have been sort of identification, be it national, geographical, even ethnicity or gender, you know. But fans, I suppose, they look at these teams and players as an extension of their own identity. Do you think that's rather simplistic, or is it true?
I think that's probably at the heart of it. And it's sometimes quite difficult to explain. You can understand if it was a local football team that somebody's following that they would get a sense of identity from it. But then you look at the global success of branded teams like Manchester United and Liverpool, who have huge global following, from people who would never go to those towns or cities. So there's something else that's happening, whether it's sort of self-identity or something else. But I think perhaps let's think about an example. I've always, I'm not a great football fan, but I've got a childhood friend who you know, has followed his local football team, now lives on the other side of the world. And yet, you know, I still see him commenting on the team, on social media. And, you know, it's almost irrational that he's miles and miles away and, you know, lives in hope of this team one day being successful, because they haven't really been successful for a long time. Perhaps you can relate to that, Ashley, in some way or other.
I sure as heck can. I mean, as you know, I'm an avid Swindon Town fan, and yeah, I don't know. I have seen them have some success, but it's sort of very varied. And I think I actually enjoy the highs and the lows, to be honest, in a way, because you appreciate the highs that much more when they do come along.
Yeah, and I think that's where it is. You know, there is an element of self-identity, but it's also emotion. It's that emotion of riding the wave with your team through the good times and the bad. And you know, that's we're emotional beings as human beings, and sport is one way that we can express that emotion.
Yeah, I mean, people have said that sometimes, you know, that fans, they get their self-worth from their team. If that was the case, then, you know, supporting Swindon, I've got very low self-worth at the moment. but do you think that's true or not?
I think, well, that's tied up in it. I think, you know, when the team's doing well, they feel good. When the team's not doing so well, they'll find ways of justifying it. But there is an element of self-worth in that. So it's self-identity, self-worth, emotion, and something else, really. But, you know, it's always irrational to a certain level.
Yeah, you talk about that irrational behaviour. And I mean, again, it's funny how we get fans in an environment or a sporting environment, and suddenly they behave in a way that they wouldn't behave in their normal life. So, you know, some of them may face paint. They may obviously scream abuse at opposing fans or even opposing players and really sort of rail against them. And, I mean, how does that work in? Is that, again, just letting their life's frustrations out through their team?
Well, I think perhaps to answer that question, you need to go back to the root of what being a fan is all about. The word fan comes from the word fanatic. So it's somebody who's fanatic about it, and it's almost akin to a religion for them. And that's interesting, because the word fanatic comes from the Middle Ages, when religion was widespread, and everybody was expected to follow religion, whether you believed it or not. But for those people who followed it and it lived their lives by it and took it incredibly seriously, they became known as fanaticus. That was a term that was used to describe the sort of collective, you know, people who really followed it were the fanatics, the fanaticus. And they were the believers, and, you know, they were the devoted ones. So that's really the origins of our word fan that we use in sport now. So Winston Churchill was quite illuminating about fanatics. He said a fanatic is somebody who can't change their mind and won't change the subject. And I think that, you know, when you're down the pub with your friends who are particularly fanatical about a club or a sport or a sports person, that's what it is. They won't change their minds whatever you say to them, and they won't change the subject. They'll keep banging on about it.
I mean, do we know why some fans are obviously more fanatical than others. I mean, and more passionate than others. I mean, how does that come about? Again, it just seems strange that some people can obviously support their team. I suppose it's exactly what you're saying there, is that there were some who believed in religion, there were some who didn't, you know?
I think it's just part of being human. I think it's the strength of the emotional connection you feel for that particular sport or sports person. And if it's not sport, then it would be horses or animals or dogs or cars or music. Everybody, you know, if you really start digging into them and talking to them, they have something that they're fanatical about. They are fans of something. So it's not just sport. That's something that is just part of the human condition.
And it's funny you mention that, and that emotional thing, and we joke about my support of Swindon, but, you know, before we spoke to you, I was reading about how often this sort of fanatical or this fan behaviour or passion for a team comes from the emotion of nostalgia. And I must admit, you know, I remember the first days as a child going to watch Swindon play, and I remember going to watch them, you know, during my late single digit years into my teens, and it is, they are happy memories, you know, they're very nostalgic memories that probably are the ones that I cling to. And I also think it's interesting that people say that the heroes when you're 13 are your heroes for the rest of your life, and so maybe there is that emotional thing, as you say, that is very real.
I think that you know, your young years and your teenage years are very important in forming your views for life. And I think parental influence is also very, very key. You talk to fans and they'll say they were fans because they remember watching with their dad or their parents. And it was a family thing. Your love of Swindon is possibly the other side of the coin from my complete disinterest in the world of football. I grew up in a house, very similar to yours. Both my parents were doctors. But my dad had no interest in sport whatsoever, no interest in football. And I've always always suggested that my reason for not liking football is because I came from Swindon, with a team that never was very successful. So I think, you know, it is a flip side of both. You can be influenced in one direction and the other.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I find interesting about sort of sporting fans as well is if you look at sporting contests, you know one team is going to lose and one team is usually going to win. Occasionally there are some sports where you can get a draw. So it seems kind of a strange one where you can go to a match knowing that the chances are your team is going to lose or your hero is going to lose, yet there's still that passion there. And it's like, would you go to a restaurant if you knew you were going to have a bad meal? No, you wouldn't, would you?
No, that's true. I think but that's part of the eternal optimism of sport and the human condition, is that, you know, you might be there. That's the same reason as people buy a lottery ticket, is that, you know, they may win one day.
No, I suppose, yeah, that's very true. I mean, the other thing that's interesting is, you know, the dedication of fans. And if we look at that, you know, there are some fans that are incredibly dedicated to their teams. And I read this great analysis that said, you know, that many of them about is being member of a family, and if that family, you have a distinct role, and so, you know, again, as a fan, you have a role there that doesn't really change over the years. And it was saying how, you know, the connections in their family are strong and long lasting, as they are to fandom as well. I mean, do you think that again is making it too simplistic, or is it a very real situation?
I think if you listen to the fans, and the way they talk on social media or even down the pub, you know, it's often about us and we. So they identify as being part of the family, as you say. And I think they share in that success of the family. And there's a lot of work being done in, fan psychology of how fans relate to that sort of family nature, when they're successful. And it's a behaviour called birging, B-I-R-G-ing, is basking in reflected glory. So if your team wins, you're part of the family that's sharing that success, and you know, they are celebrating it. And you'll see on social media people saying, "We won," It's that definite collective sense of family that comes from success. The flip side of that, of course, is when the team fails, there's another fan behavior that is called coughing, cutting off reflected failure. So when your team loses, you don't really want to associate yourself with that loss. And to a certain extent, you don't want to associate your team with that loss. And so you tend to find fans commenting with a reason for that loss, which is beyond the control of the team. It was something that was outside their control. It was the weather conditions. It was the referee, or it's the manager, something that sort of removes them from that sense of failure. So those two behaviours, burping and coughing, really, I think, are at the heart of the sort of that sense of the collective that fans have when they're following the sport.
Do you think that social media and the dawn of the sort of internet and all of that has made those emotions, or the coughing or the burping, become even more prevalent than they were probably, you know, 30 years ago?
I think social media has become the platform for burping and coughing. It provides you an instant opportunity to comment on what's going on. And if you're watching a live sporting event and also watching the social media streams for a team or a sport at the same time, you know, it is almost instant. You know, as soon as something's happened, there are comments, there are opinions out there. You know, we could have a whole separate show about fan behavior on social media. But there's a lot of things that that you've got to watch out for if you're a team. First of all, you know, the fans can allow their coughing, their cutting off reflective failure to get out of hand. And it can be sometimes they can let their emotions run away with them and themselves, and it becomes either rude or abusive or offensive in terms of the way they're trying to cut off that reflective failure. And you've seen, you know, quite a few examples of that. For a team, I think the traditional view was used to be, don't engage the trolls, don't engage the people who are coughing. But I think that's changed now. And if you get engagement and debate, quite often, if you point out to people that, you know, as a team, that you're being a little bit offensive, you know, quite often the comment will be is, first of all, oh, they're listening. Secondly is, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I got a bit emotional there and I got carried away and I won't do it again. But you really do need to, I think, as a sports team, engage with the fans. And if you're going to do that, then as a team, you really need to have a very clear tone of voice, a style that you develop so that you have a consistent communication with fans on social media. But I think it's a great platform to get that sort of those fanatics for your side, talking and discussing and debating. But you do need to have a little bit of moderation with it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you believe that obviously social media has enhanced the fan experience, but it is still a very dangerous area. But you'd have to have somebody very expert in the communication side of things, I would think, that they don't get emotionally involved and start defending the club too vehemently or their sport or the athlete to keep that balance and to, as you say, calm down some of the vitriol from the fans.
Well, I think that's why, you know, developing a tone of voice for your club is very important. You can have several people who are running a social media account for the club, and you need to work very closely with them to make sure that they, you know, they don't get involved in the emotion, that there is a sort of a style of response to a certain given situation that, you know, that tries to stick to facts rather than vitriol, and just really manages that platform of communication. You're never going to stop people being emotional, but I think, you know, you can call them out when they overstep the mark.
No, it's a very interesting area, and I mean, we could go on talking for ages. But one thing as well that I found very interesting was reading up before we had this chat was the, you know, the Chicago Cubs apparently were one of the very first clubs in the world to have a fan day where they would have a picnic on the ballpark for their fans. And then the CEO was saying there how one of the reasons they allow so many people to propose to their future wife on the pitch or, you know, down at the ballpark The reason was because then they will have an anniversary that's linked to the club and they will keep coming back over the years, which I thought was an incredibly clever sort of marketing tactic. But it is amazing how things like a proposal and sport and being a fan just get so intertwined.
Well, I think you've got to view it from the club's perspective. You know, the fans are part of the family. They are the source of your support and your emotional energy for the team. But they're also a source of money. And you know, sport is an expensive thing. Sports people are expensive, and you know, you've got to find the money. And so you know, the fan organisations of sporting teams have become very sophisticated in the way that they build up that sense of belonging, and also then find ways of providing products and opportunities that you know, fans can exchange their hard-earned cash for. You know, you look at a club like Manchester City. They have a very sophisticated marketing database, which they regularly mail out to their what they call their citizens, offers and chances to buy clothes and come to games and all those sort of things. But it is a marketing operation, and the aim is to extract cash from the fans to pay for the sport.
You obviously look at this space a lot more than I do. I sort of dip in there every now and again. I mean, are there any clubs or athletes who you would say handle the fans really, really well, that to you is in a sort of brand and reputation consultant's perspective is just a brilliant organisation in the way they handle it?
I think I would probably look at the top. All the top football teams, I think, do this extremely well. So Manchester United, Manchester City, Arsenal, they all have very sophisticated marketing organisations. They have destination venues that you can come to. So their stadiums are, you know, are open to fans to come have a look at, have tours. They have other events there that bring other people into the venues. And I think they're just very sophisticated in the way they engage with their fans and keep that sense of family going on a global level. And I think that's the impressive bit, that is that they reach far beyond their normal heartland of their, you know, within the sort of catchment area of their city, and they are engaging with people right across the world.
No, it's certainly been interesting, David, catching up with you once again. And I'm going to have to let you go because we've been going for a while, but I could talk to you for ages about this because it's just so fascinating. But thanks very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure, and do have me back again.
No, I'm sure we will. You've already pricked my mind about a few more ideas we could have a chat with you about.
Thanks very much.
I'm Azuma Nelson, and you are listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. That's my favourite one, I must admit. Eartha Kitt in the background.
Yes, a bit of Eartha. You were always a big fan of Batman, weren't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you like the campy one, not the serious movie Val Kilmer one.
I liked some of the early ones of those, but yeah, I did enjoy the sort of kitsch.
The 60s, TV show.
Adam West.
Yeah. No, Burt Ward as Robin.
Pow!
Didn't they have a good time off screen as well, just quietly?
Anyway, that was David Mitchell, the personal brand and reputation consultant, as I say, with a bent for the F1 and racing drivers in the F1. And I thought it was really interesting, just some of the observations of fans and why fans are so dedicated. But it was interesting, John, how he was saying how important now, and some of the top sporting clubs are really investing their time in that, the tone in which they respond to comments on Facebook, on Twitter, from fans. And they make sure that they actually, the engagement is a really good one, and it calms down ones that get really sort of antsy. And at the same time, but they're really professional, and they've invested in top quality people to handle that space.
Just a couple of those definitions again.
Yeah, berging, basking in reflected glory. And I think there's quite a lot of fans who do that. And then there's coughing, which is cutting off reflected failure.
So being a fan of someone and then dropping them.
Yeah,
they
if
do
they've
something you don't like.
Yeah, if suddenly they failed, say at an Olympic Games, and you just go, oh, I've got nothing to do with that now, and you just sort of diss them completely.
Yeah, interesting. I often when people are talking about who teams they support, so you're a so and so supporter sucked in because of whatever, I always have this line about, well, mate, I don't know what you're going on about, because a random outcome of a sporting event that I'm not involved in and played by people who I don't know is not a measure of my own self-worth. That's not how I measure my self-worth, whereas a lot of people do.
Well, that's what we were talking about there, you know. Yeah. And again, we were sort of even looking at my Swindon Town Alliance, you know, as David was saying in the interview.
Well, you're just a mental person.
Well, you know, as he said, if you look at it, it's kind of irrational in that I live the other side of the world, yeah, yet they still have their claws into me, and I'm still, you know, really, it's the first thing I look at on a Saturday night before I go to bed is whether they've won or lost.
But you'd do that if you were still living in Swindon, wouldn't you?
I'd be watching them if I was still there.
So yeah. It's not as if that's that weird. Is it?
No, I don't think it is.
I think it becomes weird when you look at those results and you see Swindon lost 2-1 and you go, oh, God damn it, man, and you're grumpy for a week. Or if you look at it and go, oh, they won 2-1, yippee, happy days. That's when it's a problem. If you can look at it and go 2-1, oh, it's a pity they lost. And that's all that it is to you.
Yeah, it takes a few minutes. I'm a bit like, oh, damn, we lost again. You know? But there's one team, yeah, if we lose to them, then I'm afraid it is like that does affect me a couple of days. The team down the A420.
Who's that?
We don't mention their name on this show, John.
Can't we?
No, we can't do that, I'm afraid.
So they're like Hawthorn and Collingwood and West Coast. It's got that sense.
They're worse than all of them.
Are they? Okay. Now, you mentioned Usain Bolt. Let's continue that discussion going, because it's very interesting, because it morphed off from the discussion we were having about netball. So what is the true place of a marquee player? What is really the expectation of what they should be bringing? Let's just start with that.
My understanding that is the marquee player has to, so he falls outside the salary cap. He has to come with an international reputation. So he's played at the highest level internationally for big clubs in Europe, and he's a big name player. Now, the key thing is that he will bring people through the gate, and he will help raise the profile, not of only just the A-League, but also of the club that he plays for.
I mean, the criteria are very fluffy, and that's not a criticism of them. Obviously, it's very hard to write down. It can't be like a driving test, you know. Do you, light turns red, do you press go, or do you stop? It's not like that. There's no, like, set, boom, 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 you can set up, because it's such a fluid situation.
Yeah, and I think one of the problems you have with it is if you look at it, and probably Alessandro Del Piero was one of the biggest names. Could he still play football? I don't think he could. As much as it was hyped up, and every time he fell over, oh, that was brilliant play by him, and then you saw on the replay that he just fell over, you know, like he was hardly fouled at all. But he won a free kick, and the referees weren't brave enough to give him a yellow card for diving, because he was Alessandro Del Piero. And then if you look at it, he screwed up Sydney FC because he couldn't run. Their midfield was a disaster while he was there, because, you know, other players were having to cover for his inability to run anymore. So to me, that's a real catch-22. If you're going to come, but you can't be guaranteed that the player's going to play. And looking at the Del Piero one, if you look at when he went to the Indian Super League after the A-League, where we were still praising him and were going, you know, he was going to be the player of the year or whatever, India, he got dropped after, I think it was 3 games. They went, you're finished, mate.
Yeah.
And the Indian League is a long, long way below the A-League. So
I'd like to think so.
Yeah, you would. I mean, again, they bring in players from overseas. Some of them are well past their use-by date and get paid money. And, I mean, if you looked again, David James, the England goalkeeper, was one that they went, my God, you know, like, you're not there anymore either. And so they actually, I think from memory, they cancelled his playing contract but kept him on as a coach. But it's a difficult one, because you need to make sure that if you're bringing in players over a certain age, that they are still performing, and there are players that can still perform, as Ryan Giggs showed, you know, in the Premier League.
Oh, definitely. How many marquee players have won a title? Well, see, interesting in the sense that when I think of marquee players who've come to the A-League, your Del Pieros, your Fowlers, your Dwight York, but there's been other marquee players who've gone under the radar, who've been playing at Newcastle, or the young guy, the Japanese guy Honda, who's at Melbourne now. I mean, he's essentially gone under the radar. The full-on football followers would know about him, but for people who don't follow, the sort of people that you're trying to suck in to grow your sport and support it, they don't know who he is. He's not going to drag any of those people in.
But you see, again, John, this is where I think the marquee system, if you're going to have it, you have to market those players. It's not just a case of paying them a big fat salary. You need to be out there really promoting this player and going, this is what he is. He's quality. He's this, that, and the other. Now, but then I'm going to contradict what I've just said, because we saw this with then when teams were coming over here, like Del Piero, and the Perth Glory were promoting Del Piero, and he plays for the opposition. Now, when I was training in the advertising world, the one thing you never did was promote your opposition. You never refer to them. Can you imagine, like, a politician promoting in an ad the opposition? You just would not do that. And so,
well, to be fair, the federal government's doing its best to promote the opposition at the moment.
Actually, that's probably true. Yeah, so they're very good at that. But no, so I think it's a difficult one. I mean, Honda, I think, as you say, his CV is amazing. He should be promoted.
Oh, good player.
Thomas Broich was probably one that came under the radar
again,
in terms of, but was successful, was a phenomenal player.
He won two titles. I mean, yeah. The big name players that have come here, your Yorks, your Fowlers.
To me, Dwight York was the best.
Well, he's the only one that's won a title of those big name players. Del Piero didn't win one at Sydney.
No,
Fowler didn't win one.
No, and the other thing about Dwight York, which is the interesting thing, is he's the only player, foreign player, to have left the A-League and gone and played back in a higher league. All of the others, when they've left here, have gone to play, that they've either gone to play in the Indian Super League, or they've gone to play in lower division competitions, or in countries like Romania and whatever. I think Traore, who was a young player the Gold Coast had, and from memory I think he went to Victory after that, he again is one of the few foreign players to have come over here and projected and gone up and played at a higher level. And I think from memory, he's playing in Switzerland now and for his national team. So there's not enough of that. Like, I mean, and credit goes to Miron Blyberg for bringing him in and the Gold Coast United, because they saw a talent. They signed him when he was young. He wasn't a marquee player, mind you, but he was an overseas visa player.
Okay. But specifically that marquee player, because they don't have a good track record necessarily of bringing titles to your team.
And I question whether they've actually brought value to the A-League and to the clubs.
Now, let's get back to where this started with Usain Bolt, right? Now, you said a bit earlier, a bit disappointed about what's gone on over the weekend and overshadowing the opening round and the talk of his potential signing, and the FFA's come out and had their 2 cents worth, et cetera, et cetera. Being a cynic, do you think it's not, it actually turned out to be good timing for the FFA, considering what was going across the weekend soccer? And I'm talking specifically about the VAR.
Oh, look, yeah.
Because that is a shambles.
It's not the best. Yet at the World Cup, it worked well.
So the problem, once again, we're finding with the technology is it comes down to a human decision at the end. Whether it's the human standing out in the middle of the park with the whistle in his hand, or the bloke up in the box, whoever it happens to be, it's a human error. And the human error can occur. Doesn't matter how much technology you bloody well have, there's still room for human error.
Absolutely.
And let me get this right. It is actually the umpire that makes a final decision,
referee.
Isn't it? Referee in football. Like in a lot, just about every other sport, it's a bloke up in the box who makes that decision and then tells the person on the field. Now, I think rugby union, don't they have a bit where they consult with the referee?
Yeah, so the referee will say, I think it's a try. Tell me, you know, if I can or I can't award it, if there's any reason not to award the try.
But that he doesn't actually get shown footage or asked his opinion about it. Anything
now, he can watch
that.
It on the big screen when the replay is there.
But he has no input into the decision making itself once he's posed the question.
Yeah, usually it's down to the video referee, and but he will then say, okay, can you confirm that his foot didn't go into touch, because it looked to me as if... So he can double check it that way.
Okay, but he doesn't actually make the decision.
I think then they go...
As opposed to football.
Yeah, usually
soccer.
You hear the video referee will go, there's no reason why you should change your decision.
So in just about all cases, the decision is made by the person in the box, not by the person on the field with the whistle in their hand. But it is in football.
Yeah.
That he goes to the sideline and watches a little tiny screen with a little cover over his head. Is that where the problem with that system is? Should it just... Once the referee does that video signal, it's out of his hands.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Whether that should be the way it's done in other sports. I tend to agree with you that it would be better to do it that way.
Well, I don't... excuse me. I don't think that they would have awarded that goal. I don't think... It would have been awarded if someone had made the decision in the box. But when you're asking the person on the field who's already made a decision, now his decision's being questioned, and they're asking him to deliberate on
his own decision.
No, I got that right, mate. I got that right. I'm going to find anything I can possibly find in that video replay to justify the position I've taken.
The thing I would like to see, though, is a system where within the referees in the A-League, in the officials, is that you have more than you need. And so they're on a graded level. So if you make a mistake, and if in that situation you go, well, that's how I saw it, and I'm going to watch the replay, and I still see it the same way, even if it's wrong, and it's just sheer bloody-mindedness, then afterwards, when they review your performance, you move down the pecking order. And you may miss a week, but then someone else comes up, and you may miss more than 1 week, because if everybody performs well, then why should you change it? And I just think it's a little bit of a cozy thing that the same referees get gigs every week, and the A-League referees now, the packages they're on, it's pretty good money.
Well, there's been a bit of talk about making referees full-time. I don't know, is there a need for that in football?
These are essentially, John, I mean, they have other jobs, but they have a retainer paid by the FFA, and then they get a match fee as well.
Okay, so it's not like they're paying for their own costs or anything like that. Yeah. Not quite like hockey umpires yet.
No, you know, I mean, the other thing I think with the only thing with the video, and you know I don't like it when cricket with LBWs, but that's another story, but I think sometimes... The problem we have now with this new technology is we slow it down so far that you don't see, you need to watch it in real time, because often it looks so bad in slow motion. But if you see it in real time, the player's not got a chance to pull out, or the player only had eyes for the ball, and yet you don't see that when it's slowed down.
And the classic example of that is that goal that was scored against Australia by France in the World Cup, the penalty. Where, you know, the referee blew that the Australian player had taken the other guy down. But if you watch that in real time, and even in slow motion, is there contact? Yes. You've got to say there's contact, it happens. But there was no way that player was getting the ball. If contact hadn't happened, that ball was rolling out over the sideline, over the back line, because he'd kicked it in front of him and was waiting to take the penalty, waiting to get the foul. And that's where I think VAR should be used more effectively in understanding, as you say, what was going on at real time. When you slow it down and you only look at that little tiny frame of what happened there, yes, penalty. But when you look at the extended version of it in real time, you go, there's no way he was going to be able to score because the ball was going out the back line anyway. It shouldn't have been a penalty.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you see some really bad ones in rugby union now where balls are up in the air and two players are contesting it, and you see players penalised, and yet if you watch them, they only have eyes for the ball and they're not looking to take the opposite player.
What did you make of Israel Folau's suspension?
Which one was that?
For jumping into, was it the Irish, not Irish, a couple of months ago now, he copped a week or 2 weeks for taking the aerial ball. He went into I'm sure it was Scotland or Ireland or someone like that.
I think it was against Ireland. I can't remember now. I actually can't remember the incident. I think at the time I thought it was okay.
Yeah. He jumped up at the ball, and the Irish guy had been lifted by his teammate up to take the ball as well, and basically hit him on the way through and knocked the Irish guy onto the ground, and he copped a week suspension for it. So, well, It's two guys attacking the ball.
Yeah, look, I got to be honest, I can't actually remember it now, so I probably shouldn't comment.
No, another time.
Absolutely. And another time we should catch up again.
We shall. Thanks, mate.
Some people are on the fence. They think it's all over. They can't go.
See ya. We'll be back next week.